As is no surprise to the regulars here, we're continuing through the books of the Bible and the sermons, and we're starting the second half of the year and starting the New Testament to get 27 books into 26 weeks, not to mention leaving some gaps for topical lessons and things. Had to make some choices, so I've combined Matthew, Mark, and Luke into one lesson this morning. and the term for that is the Synoptic Gospels. What is that? We'll get there. just run with it for now. To give you a one-word answer, the ones that aren't John. and as Walter, I was talking to Walter after the class on the parables, which he just started today also. And helped flesh out a lot of points that I was going to make as well and highlight those differences with John and the other three Gospels. So you've kind of got a hint at that already if you're here for the class. So so go ahead and begin. I for now, I'll keep the same timeline I've been using, which is from, you know, creation pretty much to Jesus. And, of course, these three books are in the time of Jesus. I think starting next week, I'll probably, like, zoom in on the timeline and do more of just the first century or something like that. because it's going to be the exact same spot on the timeline pretty much for the next 6 months if I don't do that. So, but obviously, you know, when these books take place. I would say most people do. I hate to assume, but I think generally most people are familiar enough with the Bible that they know that Matthew and Mark, Luke and John talk about Jesus. I think that is pretty well known. So what are the Synoptic Gospels? What does that mean? And again, just to give it away, it's the three that aren't John. And that seems like a silly distinction, but John's really different from the other three. And so they just, somebody somewhere decided to come up with a complicated name for the other three. And, Synoptic. I didn't look it up. I assume it's like the word synopsis, is like a summary. And so I assume it's the same idea. I don't think it has a hugely religious meaning. just that the style's different. But again, just in case it's new information to you, I will say what the Gospels are, because the books themselves don't say this is a Gospel, except perhaps Mark. So the four books are just the stories about Jesus while he walked the earth. Okay, so to put a fine point on that, there's 27 books in the New Testament. 23 of them are about after Jesus left earth, right? Four of them are about when Jesus was on the earth. Now, again, if you're not familiar, I think most people are, but if you're not, the end of Matthew is not, so it goes Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, right? So at the end of Matthew, Mark doesn't pick up where Matthew left off. Okay, they all tell the same basic stories from some kind of beginning of Jesus to his death and resurrection, and you know, Luke includes the ascension, but the basic, you know, life of Jesus, especially mostly the ministry of Jesus is what's in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. But they're all telling those same three-ish years, you know, over and over and over again. Because I say that, you may think like everyone knows that. I have met at least one person that did not know that and thought they were just like sequential. But no, Jesus doesn't die four times. it's telling the same story each time. So, just in case there's anyone here that is not familiar with that, I did want to throw that out there. But John is the one that's different. So it's said that John's gospel, John's book, is 90% unique. So his material does not overlap very much with the other three. The other three are very similar. There's certain differences, clear differences, and we'll kind of talk about that a little bit. I'm not an expert on all that, so I've learned a lot in the last week, but I couldn't tell you everything that's different about the three gospels, but There are some differences, but the same basic rhythm is there. For a summary, I didn't get very clever with this. Jesus of Nazareth was a real person who was also God. That's a pretty wild story that needed to be told. If we didn't have these accounts, then where would we read about it, right? So, again, it may be a thing that most people, especially in America, know about, but it had to be written. So that's what they did. And of course, the big conclusion of it is that Jesus died, was killed at a young age, you know, not in his 70s or anything, but, you know, in his early 30s, it seems, or roughly so. You know, was killed having done no wrong. And when we say that, usually we mean like, you know, well, he did some bad things, but nothing worthy of death. But Jesus literally did no wrong. He died by God's purpose so that anyone could be forgiven of their sins as long as they believe and obey him. Which there's a lot involved with obeying him, but in summary, that's what he came for. Okay, so I usually do this slide of why this book is special, but we're doing three, and I wanted to highlight why each one is special among the synoptic gospels. So they're all telling you that Jesus is the Messiah, but in different ways. So Mark's the hardest to pin down, and we're studying Mark on Wednesdays as well, so and I'm teaching it, so I should be more familiar with this. And I still struggle with exactly how to explain Mark, so I'm going to do my best. But anyway, so Matthew, it's clear. I mean, as far as we know, they're all anonymous as far as opening it, right? The book of Matthew, it doesn't say, I'm Matthew and I wrote this book. None of them do. But tradition strongly, you know, points to the authors of Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and Matthew being, you know, a Jewish apostle, you would not be shocked that his message is that Jesus is the Messiah of the Jews and written to a Jewish audience. Okay. Makes sense. I'm going to skip around on this slide. Luke is, not an apostle and, possibly a, actually, I'm not entirely sure of his background, but he his book largely focuses on Gentiles and outcasts. So Jesus being the Messiah to those people outside of the historical nation of Israel, right? So that's a very different approach from Matthew. So Mark, like I say, Mark's much shorter than the others. Lot of similarity to Matthew, but shorter. And so you say, well, what does Mark have to tell us that's unique, or what's his angle? And I've struggled with that a lot. But my family could tell you I had like two study Bibles out on the table, and then I had like one on the computer online, which is the ESV one, which I actually have a paper copy of that anyway, but, and I'm just reading everybody's like, you know, version of this. And so, but what Mark does uniquely, of course, because it's short, he goes rapidly, and, the whole point is he's not trying to convince you about his Jewish background. He actually does take time to explain, more as if you didn't know that, you know, the whole Old Testament. He rarely quotes the Old Testament. Matthew quotes it a lot. Mark doesn't as much because, I mean, his audience, which it's thought to be, a Roman audience, like Roman. I mean, everyone's in the Roman Empire at this point, right? But I mean, like a Roman audience. They wouldn't really know. So, I mean, you're citing evidence to an audience that didn't understand or didn't have familiarity with it. So why, you know, in a sense, why bother, right? You're not really convincing anybody by quoting a text that they don't believe in. So, yet. Anyway, so he's just making the case of Jesus is the Messiah. Like, and then if you're the Roman audience, you'd probably say, what's a Messiah? Do I need a Messiah? What is that? You know? And so I think his is simple because it needs to be simple. There's no point in adding to me. I mean, that's the way I'm kind of understanding it. There's no point in adding all this extra things about, the Old Testament quotes and all this background. You need to know a little bit about it, about how he's the fulfillment of it, but he's just trying to get straight to the point. and so I can see that. I think that makes a little more sense. It's not just that, you know, Mark was the unfinished gospel and then Matthew kind of did a little more work on it or anything like that. I mean, that's kind of how some scholars seem to present it, you know, like his was the source material, but it's a different purpose. And so, there's got to be a purpose, right? There's always a purpose behind having these books. Why would we have just an extra gospel, that's so similar to Matthew, except shorter? So, I can see that being the reasoning behind it. Mark tends to focus on suffering more than others. Okay, so to go along with that, just looking at the first verse of each one, I should go over. I'll read Luke directly because I only have a portion of it on the screen. But Matthew, written to the Jews, right? So first verse of the book, the book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, son of Abraham. That sounds very Jewish, you know. So his readers would know what that is. That kind of flags it right away. He's a Jewish audience. Mark, beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. So, gospel, it's good news. So, again, if you've never heard of Jesus, you know, you kind of need to know that part. Like, I'm not just telling you a story. Like, this is some good news you need to know about. And then he's the Son of God. Well, that sounds odd. I'm kind of intrigued. I might want to read that, you know. And then Luke, let me read this directly. So I have King James in front of me here, which is different from the slide. For as much as many have taken in hand to set forth in order a declaration of those things which are most surely believed among us, and he goes on from there. That's some dense writing, right? So he's presenting a case, right? His is a more thorough, you know, case to make. It's not, you know, building on Jewish history as much as just saying, you know, I've really researched this and I'm trying to convince you that, Jesus is the Messiah. And then I think we'll come back to this, but to go along with the Gentile idea, it's not subtle. If you look at the timeline, which we'll get to, about half the book is unique. This big section in the middle of Luke, from the end of chapter 9 to the beginning of chapter 19. I mean, that's like roughly 10 chapters out of 24. Like, it's almost half the book, is this section where Jesus is traveling through some other regions that aren't recorded in the other, synoptic gospels. And he meets all these outcast type people. You know, he's not in Jerusalem. He's not even in his hometown of Galilee. He's in these other regions. I didn't realize that until this week. I didn't realize how big of a chunk and separately that is set out. And Luke is the only one that records a lot of that. He's the only one that talks about the prodigal son. You know, and I think Zacchaeus, he's got a lot of unique material in there. So, you know, you think of those stories and you think about how they're, you know, people that would have been thought to be unreachable, and Luke's the one that focuses on those. So, okay. Main characters, you probably know. Jesus is a carpenter's son from a small town. kind of the focus of the books. There's John. I'll call him John the Baptizer. It's fine to call him John the Baptist. I usually say that, but I like the phrasing of John the Baptizer, because it makes it clear he's, you know, it's not a title, in the sense of, you know, normal titles. It's just what he does. He baptizes. And it's just, possibly just to be clear, that it's not the same as John the Apostle. It's a different John. This is John, this is Jesus' cousin. and of course, his focus is toward the beginning of these books, that he's preparing the way for Jesus. You've got the 12 apostles that are Jesus's students that travel with him. And then you've got the Jewish leaders. Pharisees, I think, come up. I didn't do a study on this, but I think they come up the most. And it's never good. unless there's one occasionally that's mentioned as, you know, he was among the Pharisees, but he believed in Jesus. But usually they're not presented well, because they've blinded themselves to the Messiah that's often literally standing in front of them. all right. So, again, with an outline. Of course, normally when I do this, I have chapter numbers on here. I will get to that in a second. First, let's kind of look at this outline more broadly. So to say something that's not on the slide, the book of John records, I think, three times that Jesus observes Passover in Jerusalem, is what I read. I haven't double checked this, but the point is John records times that Jesus will travel to Jerusalem. His ministry's in Galilee, which is a kind of far away place from Jerusalem. But he does actually make some business trips, if you will, to Jerusalem, you know. So it's not that he's only there, but the three synoptic gospels that we're talking about today really don't discuss any of that. They just stay in Galilee for the first big chunk. So this is another thing I really didn't piece together. But the locations of these gospels, it's really easy to follow. I've just always taken it as, you know, when you just throw a bunch of city names at me, I'm lost, you know, and the audience might be like, oh yeah, well, obviously that's up in Galilee and, you know, that's down over here and everyone kind of knows this region and we know what you're talking about. Well, we don't, right? So, I hear place names and I just kind of gloss over a little bit and have to focus myself in. But the flow of the Gospels is really simple. The big chunk of it's in Galilee. I mean, there's, of course, the stories that record Jesus' birth. You know, he goes to Bethlehem to be born, or he doesn't. Well, yeah, he does. But anyway, he's born in Bethlehem. He goes to Egypt for a time. You know, there's these different, a few different places mentioned. That's pretty brief. His ministry is all in Galilee, maybe a little bit on the outskirts, like Tyre and Sidon, and the Syrophoenician woman is kind of on the outskirts of Galilee, but it's still up in the north. Okay. So that's the big chunk of most of this. And that's most of the teaching that you read about that Jesus does is in Galilee. Almost all of the miracles are up in Galilee. So that's the bulk of it. You've got the travel to Jerusalem, which, like I mentioned before, Matthew and Mark have like a chapter or two on this. Luke has like 10 chapters on this, right? So that's a whole different region, but that's his journey there. The map I thought was interesting because in the end of Luke 9, it says that the Samaritans wouldn't allow Jesus to pass through there. That's obviously a more direct route, right? I mean, this line's all zigzag, right? Like, why didn't he just walk straight through Samaria to get to Jerusalem? Well, because he wasn't allowed to. They refused him passage for some reason. and so it's not known, but it's thought that he, you know, crosses over the Jordan, goes through this region called Perea, and then, how ironic, crosses the Jordan into Jericho to get to Jerusalem. Sounds like what the Israelites did, right? And, but then, of course, then it ends in Jerusalem, with that final week of Jesus' life before he's resurrected and everything. But it's a pretty simple flow, right? He's you know, ministry in Galilee, travels to Jerusalem, then the last week is in Jerusalem, and then he's killed and he's resurrected. But and some of the 40 days after he rises to life again is in Galilee, but seems to end in Jerusalem also. So I just found that really helpful. It's something I didn't know was so straightforward. I just pictured Jesus just kind of bouncing around everywhere across, you know, the Israelite region, but not really. It's mostly just Galilee and then a journey to Jerusalem. So I'll put the chapter numbers up there. I don't expect anyone would have time to write this down if you're taking notes. But there they are. I'll put this online if you want to see it, or you can take my notes with you. But that's a little much to write down. So, but it is, it's just pretty linear. It's not as all over the place as you might expect. And so to kind of wrap up our overview of the three, again, I didn't try to come up with some clever thing, to say as a theological point of these. It is really the point is that Jesus died, so that we could be right with God. And as we talked about with Mark's gospel, to convince you that you need that. The Jewish audience might know that they have sin. The Gentile audience may be looking for hope. The outcasters may be looking for hope. Outcasts, I don't know why I put that on there anyway. But some may not even know that they need God and they need a Savior. But that is the point of these Gospels, is to teach that. I kind of covered the rest of that already. So, I'll put the recap up for a minute. If you want to turn to Mark chapter 8, and we'll do our story from there. Mark chapter 8. I'll just give everyone a second to take notes if you want to. All right. It's Mark 8, 27 through 38. It's going to be quite familiar. It's as a summary, there's a lot that goes on in 10 verses. But as a summary, I would focus on that Jesus is speaking plainly, and several translations use that word. He's speaking plainly about how he is going to die, that he must suffer, and that anyone that wants to follow him will suffer also. So why is this story special, and why on earth did I pick this out of all the stories in the Synoptic Gospels? Well, one, it's common to all three. but it's the middle. It's the middle of the story. And this is something, again, I learned in preparing for this. This chunk is, like I say, it's common to all three Synoptic Gospels. Depends on your translation. There's possibly, two or three different headings in your Bible for this chunk of 10 verses. And that's fine. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But if you're like me, you're used to this being three different stories. And, what I think is interesting is how connected they all are. And they're presented in the exact same order, as a one after the other, same moment, you know, same scene kind of story. And it marks a turning point, in the Gospels, to where Jesus is saying, you know, it says plainly, right? And so as we talked about with the parables class, a lot of the time Jesus was not plain when he was telling people things and telling the disciples things. But in here, it's changed. And he's like, I'm going to die. People are going to kill me. You're going to suffer also. And he's very point blank. And then pretty soon after this, he starts heading to Jerusalem. So it is kind of the hinge in the middle of the story of Jesus, of the ministry story of Jesus is, this is when things change. The very next story in all three synoptic gospels, the very next story after this is the transfiguration. Something definitely changed, in that story, right? He's transfigured. He's changed before them, right? So, it really hints at something is going to change now. So that's why I thought this story was unique and be a good one to highlight out of the entire, three gospels. So, of course, the main characters being Jesus, who's teaching. Peter is the one that's going to confess that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and then say something bad that gets him in trouble. And then, of course, there's a crowd also. Mark highlights that. So some will say the disciples. Some of the Gospels will say Jesus speaks to the disciples, but Mark in verse 34 here says, when he called the people unto him with his disciples also, he said unto them. So there's also a crowd here listening, not necessarily to the part where Peter's rebuked and where Jesus says, I'm going to die, but they're listening to the other part. So, all right, so it's three simple, well-known stories that I would say is very much tied together. One is where Peter, says that Jesus is the Christ, when Jesus asks. And then he says, I'm going to die soon. And Peter says, no, that's not going to happen. And Jesus famously says, get behind me, Satan, to him. And then Jesus goes on from there. And tells the crowd, you need to take up your cross daily and follow me. And what does it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses his soul? So, a lot of famous things all crammed in here, but it's one continuous scene. Let's go ahead and read it. Mark 8, starting verse 27. Jesus went out and his disciples into the towns of Caesarea Philippi. And by the way, he asked his disciples, saying unto them, whom do men say that I am? And they answered, John the Baptist, but some say Elijah, and others one of the prophets. And he saith unto them, but whom say ye that I am? And Peter answereth and saith unto him, thou art the Christ. I think Matthew says, thou art the Christ, the Son of God. Verse 30, and he charged them that they should tell no man of him. And he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected of the elders and of the chief priests and scribes and be killed and after 3 days rise again. That's really straightforward, isn't it? verse 32, and he spake that saying openly, and Peter took him and began to rebuke him. But when he had turned about and looked on his disciples, he rebuked Peter, saying, get thee behind me, Satan, for thou savorest not the things that be of God, but the things that be of men. And when he had called the people unto him with his disciples also, he said unto them, whosoever will come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whosoever will save his life shall lose it, but whosoever shall lose his life for my sake and the gospel's, the same shall save it. For what shall it profit a man if he gain the whole world and lose his own soul? Or what shall a man give in exchange for his soul? Whosoever, therefore, shall be ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of him also shall the Son of Man be ashamed when he cometh in the glory of his Father with the holy angels. 12 verses, I said 10. Anyway, I've already said this, but since I missed it for forever, I wanted to throw this out as something that, in case you missed it, but like I said, I said this already, that these three events in this one story are very connected, even though they might have different headings. So first, that Jesus is the Christ, and second, that the Christ must suffer. He says that the Son of Man must suffer, but it's in response to Peter saying, "You're the Christ." And then third, that the Christ's disciples will suffer. So it's a really clear, you know, progression there. And so, you know, we've all heard that, you know, take up your cross. One of them, I think Matthew says, take up your cross daily, follow me. And, you know, we've heard that, and it's inspiring, and it's fine to take that all by itself. But in the context of this, it's not just a random thing that Jesus said. He's talking about how he's going to die. And as we know in hindsight that, you know, he was compelled to carry his own cross. And then he tells the people listening, the whole crowd, to take up their cross. And then that, you know, what does it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses his soul? Again, he's convicting them, you know, of the need to, of the challenge of being his disciple, of being, obedient to God. And again, that kind of takes on a different meaning, you know, when he's saying, well, I'm going to go die, and, you know, you need to, you will suffer also and be prepared for that. So I was curious, in hindsight, again, for those of us, of course, that are here that believe that Jesus is the Messiah that was prophesied in the Old Testament, we can kind of look back and say, well, look at all these scriptures that said that the Messiah was going to suffer. It was not, there's no evidence that the Jewish, you know, scholars, scribes and everything, believed or put that together, that the Messiah was going to suffer, and die, for the people. We look at, you know, Isaiah 52, 53, many of us read that for the Lord's Supper, and it's illustration of the suffering of the servant, which we know to be Jesus. Zechariah 12 and verse 10 is another one that's quoted, in the New Testament. They shall look upon me whom they have pierced, and they shall mourn for him. Well, you don't mourn unless someone's died, right? As the one that mourneth for his only son, Ahem, and shall be in bitterness for him as one that is bitterness for his firstborn. So again, in hindsight, you know who that's talking about, but the Jews may not have seen that, but, perhaps they should have. And then Daniel 9, verse 26, depends on your translation. King James and New American Standard, says the Messiah will be cut off, and have nothing. But ESV says the Anointed One, and it doesn't have to be like the Messiah. Perhaps, you know, some Anointed One, but, doesn't it sound, like a prophecy now, in hindsight? So, yeah, just some things to think about there. So we'll, just kind of recap and wrap up there. We usually end with a poem. And so I was going to turn to Matthew chapter 5. If you want to get ahead of me there, Matthew 5, starting in verse 1. and grab my drink of water. And this is called the Beatitudes. pretty famous name for these sayings. It depends on your translation. Some will show it as a poem in verses 3 through 10. That's really the poem part of this. But there's kind of a setup and a conclusion around it. So I'll just read verses 1 through 12. But 3 through 10 is the poem. And you can see it because verse 3, ends with, you know, they all start with blessed are someone, right? And verse 3 ends with, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. That's the first verse of the poem. The last verse of the poem, verse 10, ends with, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. So that pretty well brackets it as, you know, this is the poem part. Also, you look at verse 11 and it says, blessed are you, or blessed are ye. And so you say, well, maybe that's still part of it, but there's a change there where everything else before it, the eight verses before it says, blessed are they, or blessed are those, or, you know, it's people over there, right? And verse 11 is blessed are you. So there's a change. And then 11's really also just kind of explaining the theme, the thing that was mentioned in verse 10. So verse 10 is blessed are those who are persecuted. And then he says, blessed are you when people persecute you in verse 11. So, he's just kind of explaining it. I've always considered it to be part of the Beatitudes, the poem, but it's really more of a conclusion after the poem than being one of the blessings, you know. So I thought that was interesting. And then some have noted that, so there's eight, like I say, eight verses, eight Beatitudes, and the first four, tend to be, inward, like how you feel. And then the last four are outward shows of faith and good works. So, thought that was interesting. So we'll go ahead and read it, and then, we'll close out. So Matthew 5, starting verse 1. And seeing the multitudes, he went up into a mountain, and when he was set, his disciples came unto him, and he opened his mouth and taught them, saying, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are they that mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are they which do hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they shall be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. Blessed are they which are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are ye when men shall revile you and persecute you, and say all manner of evil against you falsely for my name's sake. Rejoice, and be exceeding glad, for great is your reward in heaven. For so persecuted they the prophets which were before you. So, as we extend the invitation, much the same as the Beatitudes, and what we read earlier, we think of Jesus who came to earth and suffered and died for us, and the calling is a difficult one as well, that we will suffer persecution for that faith in him. And so it's not an invitation that comes lightly. Jesus often highlighted that, that it would be difficult, but it's still an invitation, to be part of something that's difficult, but well worth it. As it said in that passage we just read, that, you have a reward in heaven, when all is said and done. So, if there are any here that do wish to obey that call of the gospel, and truly commit your life, to God, or any that need the prayers of the saints, this is a good time to come forward as we stand and sing Song of Invitation.